Whether we realize it or not, our culinary landscape has been going through a revolutionary change. Supermarkets are filling their aisles with international foods we never heard of 10 years ago. Salsa now outsells ketchup. Baba Ghanoush has taken the place of the cocktail party cheese ball. And some people are even replacing the pepperoni on their pizza with Armenian lamb. Joining me now to talk about what's happening and her new cookbook, Gourmet Today, is Ruth Reichel, the editor-in-chief of Gourmet Magazine. Welcome back to our show. And I say welcome back to our show. Normally, we see each other pretty much every month, but you've been away for most of the summer.
And I have missed you.
Well, you could have taken me with you, Ruth. Where did you go?
I have been to China, Laos, Morocco, Brazil, Italy, France, England. I've been shooting a new TV show.
So you've been working this whole time. But, of course, that's a workplace situation.
It is very much a workplace situation. I was with various actors, Diane Wiest, Frances McDormand, Lauren Bracco, Tom Skerritt, Jeffrey Wright, a few other people. And we went to cooking schools in these places. And it was the most fun I've ever had. Anywhere.
Did you come upon exotic fruits and vegetables that you wish you could have included in your cookbook?
I did come upon many exotic fruits, vegetables, and other foods. I have to say that most of the things that I wished were in the cookbook are in the cookbook. The really exotic things I found, like worm larvae and ant egg salad in Laos, I'm happy not to have in the cookbook.
Now, ant eggs were so popular in Mexico as the Mexican caviar that it's become an endangered species.
Oh, too bad. Someone who harvested ant nests to get the ant egg salads, you can have them.
You said that the way that we cook has changed more in the past 10 years than in the entire history of American food. That's a stunning claim.
I think it's absolutely true.
What's happened?
Lots of things have happened. I mean, one thing is just that we have become much more sophisticated eaters. We are now, you know, young people have been raised eating interesting food. We have a generation now that was raised on supermarket sushi. They have very restless palates, restless appetites. One of the other things that's happened is that the immigration patterns have really changed. And people used to come here and thinking that they were here to stay for the rest of their lives, and they gave up their old food ways. They tried to assimilate very quickly. Today, people hang on to their food ways really proudly, and that means that the variety of ingredients that are available to us has really expanded hugely. And the other thing that's happened has been the farmers market movement, which has really expanded the kind of produce that's available to us, because if you're distributing nationally, you start going to the lowest common denominator, and you become a peas and carrot society. But if you only have to feed a small group of people, you grow what they want. So suddenly we have all of these peppers and Chinese vegetables.
I was aware of that when I lived in Chinatown. For a long time, when you had snow peas, they came out of a can. And then local farmers started growing snow peas. And then we started seeing the snow pea, the tendrils from the snow peas. And that became the really exciting thing. I think it's called water spinach to some people. And that's what you wind up eating if you really care about Chinese food. Forget the snow peas.
Well, exactly. But now you can get snow peas in the supermarket.
But they're fresh.
And you couldn't do that even 5 years ago.
So why have we become more adventurous eaters? Is it simply because it's there?
For lots of reasons. I mean, we have become a food-focused society.
And we weren't in the past?
We really weren't. I mean, I gave a speech to the newspaper editorial writers 3 years ago exhorting them to please pay attention to food. And just in 3 years, it's changed so much. I mean, that's a huge change.
The narrator of Lori Moore's new novel, Eats Sushi.
Which I just finished this morning.
You know, she eats sushi. Her mother is shocked that she eats sushi, but she's shocked that the woman she works for, who has an upscale restaurant, cooks some of the things that she cooks. There seems to be a pattern of people moving, I don't know what I want to say, because it's not up, but moving into more and more adventurous eating.
Yeah, and her father is a farmer who's growing these very specialized potatoes in the book. And, you know, in this very middle American town. And that is what's happening in America, is that we are curious. I mean, Americans are exciting eaters.
So even you find sushi even in small town malls these days?
Yeah, everywhere.
Where have you personally noticed these changes taking place most often? Is it in restaurants or is it in people's homes?
Well, I mean, I think that the supermarket, I mean, and New York is not a good supermarket city. I mean,
really?
If you look at a supermarket in a small town, they're huge. And in the little town that I have a house in upstate, there's a whole aisle of rices. It's called Rices of the World. And there are about 20 different kinds of rices for sale. It just sort of stuns me.
And why do you think it is not happening in New York? Is it a matter of space?
It's space.
But we also have specialty stores where you can get those 20 rices.
Exactly. But here, if you want to cook, you have to go from shop to shop. If you're in most small towns in America, you can get everything you need in the supermarket. And that includes Thai chili pastes and all kinds of Indian ingredients and Latino ingredients, which, you know, it's not just salsa and chips. It's yuca. It's, handmade tortillas in not just corn and wheat, but also spelt and barley. And, our larder has expanded enormously.
I've noticed also in small towns in California, in the local supermarket, the celery is better, the lettuce is better, and that's simply because they're growing it down the road.
Well, increasingly you're finding that in other places too. The supermarket I go to upstate, they have a whole section of foods from local farmers, local apples, local pumpkins, local corn.
My guest is Ruth Reichel, who visits our show regularly, normally to talk about a topic of food that changes in food, usually with somebody else. Today she's here alone, but we're talking about changes in food nonetheless, because a new cookbook, Gourmet Today, has just been published with 1,000 all-new recipes for the contemporary kitchen. And it is a reflection of all of the changes that are taking place in the American kitchen and American restaurants these days. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Epicurious.com predicted back in December 2008 that hallmarks of 2009 will include a return to families cooking together and eating at home more than they have in decades. Do you see that happening?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the recession has pretty much forced that. But I also think that people have understood the place of cooking in their families and how important it is and, you know, what a great thing it is to open the door and smell food cooking in the house, how soothing it is to people.
Well, you have a full-time job, and yet you still manage to fix dinner for your family?
Well, I love to cook. I mean, for me, it's just a complete pleasure. And that's part of what this cookbook is about, that today, you don't need to spend a lot of time cooking. More than half of these recipes can be done in less than half an hour. And there's so much help for cooks out there.
What about cooking for the kids? Every parent will tell you that if they have more than one kid, that each one has certain things that they will eat, certain things they won't eat. How do you get past that and have them eat healthy food?
It's a constant struggle, but I think that if children see their parents eating vegetables with pleasure, eating fish with pleasure, they will also eat those things with pleasure. I mean, it is not – Japanese children aren't wired differently so that they happen to like rice and fish. That's what's available to them, and that's what they eat. And if your kids aren't constantly exposed to junk food, they don't think that that's what they're supposed to be eating.
So if we're eating at home, we're less likely to be eating something that tastes like a rubber rubber hockey puck that is called a quarter pounder.
Well, yeah. I mean, part of the answer to the obesity crisis that we have is for people to cook at home and for people to understand how to use vegetables, grains, beans, this whole variety of foods which are suddenly so available to us. One of the things that I'm most proud of this book is the vegetable chapter, which is enormous and which not only has recipes for everything that you can find in farmers markets and in the supermarket, but also a box on every vegetable. So we tell you how to choose the vegetables, how to store them, and, you know, how the simplest possible way to steam, roast, or boil them.
And we have Deputy Agricultural Secretary Kathleen Merrigan saying that Americans are more interested in food and agriculture than at any time since most families left the farm.
It's absolutely true. And, you know, part of it is because we have a president and a first lady who...
There's an organic farm.
Who understand the importance of this and who, you know, actually started a farmer's market near the White House now.
She said, Mrs. Obama said, that when I travel around the world, no matter where I've gone so far, the first thing world leaders, prime ministers, kings, queens ask me about is the White House garden. And then they ask about Bo.
Well, that, I think, is a wonderful sign that they have put this garden so front and center.
You, the last cookbook that you edited, we talked about it when it came out just, what was that, 5 years ago?
5 years ago, yeah.
The Gourmet Cookbook. We described it as the most complete cookbook of all time.
Well.
And now we have a new book, so is this... is this replacing that one?
This is a totally different book. That book was really looking back at Gourmet's history. It was looking at 60 years of recipes. This book is really looking forward. It's a book for today. And there are so many ingredients in this book that just weren't available then.
Well, the Gourmet Cookbook had more classic dishes like onion soup gratiné, gefilte fish, corn fritters, peanut butter cookies. And people are starting to think about those kinds of dishes again, mainly because of the popularity of Julie and Julia.
Well, that's right. And those are...
And then now Julia Child suddenly has a bestseller after all these years.
Isn't that great? No, I mean, those are perfectly wonderful recipes, wonderful dishes, very comforting. This book is much less reliant on butter. I mean, we sometimes refer to the first book as the butter book because, you know, a little more butter makes everything.
And Julia Child used to say everything tastes better with butter.
Well, she's right. But in this book, we're going for flavor in ways that we're using ingredients like, you know, balsamic vinegar, you know, good soy sauces, sherry. We're looking for flavor in places that don't require fat. Our tastes have changed a lot.
But aren't we supposed to eat fats?
There's nothing wrong with fats. We are supposed to eat fats.
It's just the good fats, the omega-3s.
Well, I think you should eat all fats. It's just that you shouldn't have to throw fat into a dish to make it taste good.
So when you're not using butter, what are you using? Olive oil? Canola oil?
There depends on the recipe. And sometimes you're using no oil at all. I just think it's a mistake to go looking, every time you're looking for flavor, to go looking to the fat. And one of the things that's so exciting about this new marketplace that we have is that there are all these power ingredients. There's miso, for instance, which, you know, is a real umami flavor and puts a lot of flavor. A little bit will put a lot of flavor into something without adding fat.
Can spices take the place of butter?
Well, nothing can take the place of butter.
I mean, are there certain spices that you just keep on hand because you know they're going to make something taste better?
Well, I have to tell you that after this summer, one of the things that you really learn when you're traveling a lot and learning to cook from native cooks in various places is you learn about all kinds of wonderful new herbs and spices. And, you know, in Laos, I learned about, you know, really how to use chiles in so many different ways because it's one of their major food groups.
And chiles are important in a number of different places. In Mexico, where they actually, before there were chiles in Asia, there were chiles in Mexico. The Colombian exchange actually led to the growth of chiles all over the world. But we've been very uncomfortable with chiles until fairly recently. You have a recipe here called vegetable enchiladas with creamy poblano sauce. Most people would see that and think, oh, that's going to be hot.
No, that is not hot. That's poblanos are the least of.
But Mexicans also think that all chili should just warm your mouth. They shouldn't make you gasp for breath.
That's right. Laotians, however, believe differently.
Yeah, they want you to sweat.
They really, for them, this is a very poor country, and it's a way of getting a real sort of flavor rush, very simply and inexpensively.
My guest is Ruth Reichel, who is the editor-in-chief of Gourmet Magazine. We're talking about Gourmet Today, more than 1,000 all-new recipes for the contemporary kitchen, which has just been published in a huge edition. If you thought the last Gourmet cookbook, well, last one was 1,000 pages. How many is this one?
This is more than 1,000. I think it's 1,008. I actually don't have a copy with me.
Well,
so
I do, and
do.
It's published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt, and it's just about 1,000 pages.
1,000 pages of wonderful.
Here's Ruth Reichel. She only puts out books of 1,000 pages. Your next memoir is going to have to be 1,000 pages, Ruth.
I don't have time to write 1,000 pages of a memoir.
Well, now you can write about that trip to Asia, and I'm sure it'll fill 1,000 pages. We're going to take a little break. We'll be back with more right after this. We're back with Ruth Reichel talking about a new cookbook called Gourmet Today, published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. This is 1,000 pages, as we said. That means putting together an awful lot of recipes. The last one, you went back and you culled the best from old gourmet magazines. These are all new things.
These are all new. None of the rest, there's no overlap between the two books. And what we did was really wander the aisles of the supermarket. This book sort of started with my son. My son turned himself into a cook. And
coming out of your family? I'm so surprised.
Well, I was surprised because he wasn't. And then suddenly he was wanting to cook. And I started seeing the supermarket through his eyes. It was like, and suddenly, my eyes were opened and I realized that he had all these ingredients that I had sort of ignored. And he would call me up and say, what do I do? I found this great Indian vindaloo paste. What do I do with it? And it was, from these conversations that we really started looking at, what's in the supermarket now. One of the other things that Nick really precipitated was the huge vegetarian main course section, because he was bringing friends home and he'd say, Mom, will you cook dinner? And then he'd say, oh, and remember that, Katie, Zach, and Gina are all vegans. And I go, oh, what do I do now? And so I realized that if you're cooking for anybody under the age of 25, you probably need to have a few really great vegetarian and or vegan dishes in your repertoire. So we created a huge vegetarian main course section.
100 recipes.
Yeah. And then we started, Nick started asking all these questions about sustainability of fish. Can I eat this fish? Should I be buying this fish? And I realized that what I needed to say to him was, you have to ask a lot of questions when you go to your fishmonger. Ask him, where was it caught?
Well, you say another reality we're coming to understand is the ethics of eating. And that's when we worry about sustainability of seafood, that's part of that discussion, isn't it?
It's a big part of it, and it's one of the things that gives me so much hope about the future of American food, because Nick and his generation really understand in their bones that eating is an ethical act and that there are real consequences about what you choose. And they think about carbon footprint and, they think about, how animals are being raised and slaughtered, and they're thinking about, saving some fish for the future. And they're really asking questions about local food and organic food and what these terms all mean.
Part of the problem with seafood, with fish, is that for many years people didn't eat much fish, and we were told that it was really good for us.
Right.
And then we started eating it, and now we have a number of endangered fish species. We have people farming fish, which is causing all sorts of other problems.
Yeah, there are real problems with all of those things, and that's why when you go to the market, you really do have to ask, was this line caught? Was it trawler caught? And why we paid so much attention to that in the fish chapter, where we really, something we didn't do.
You even tell us whether we should, if we're getting cod, for example, whether it's good to get it from the Atlantic or the Pacific. The same, I would assume, is true for tuna.
Tuna less. I mean, tuna, you just have to be, we really should not be eating bluefin at all. There are too few of them. We have to let that population come back. But it's certainly true. Swordfish, you have to wonder where it's from. Shrimp. Wild-caught shrimp are great, and there's a wonderful wild American fishery. A lot of the farm shrimp from other parts of the world are really ecologically unsavory, and we shouldn't be eating them.
We can go to certain places to find out which fish are best to eat. Did a number of events for the Blue Ocean Institute because I believe in them. They have a website, don't they? Others?
Well, the Monterey Bay Aquarium has a wonderful website that's constantly updated that tells you, and they will send you little cards that you can put in your pocketbook or in your pocket and take to the fish market and even take to restaurants so that you know what you should and shouldn't be eating.
And the Monterey Bay Aquarium says that Arctic char is a best choice if you are eating a farm fish, because it's farmed in an ecologically sustainable manner,
and it's also a wonderful fish and a wonderful farmed salmon substitute. Most people can't tell the difference, really. I mean, it looks like salmon, and rather than getting one of those flabby farmed salmons, you're much better off getting Arctic char.
The farm salmon, I understand they put dyes in them to make them look like they're not farmed.
Oh, yeah. We once printed, actually. It was wonderful. There's a little chart that is sent to the salmon people where they can choose which color salmon they want, and they can buy the different dye.
That's kind of scary, isn't it?
Well, because otherwise you would end up with these, sort of creepy white salmon.
By the way, if you want to see the kinds of recipes we're talking about, we have a fairly large selection of recipes on our show page at WNYC.org. Of course, not all 1,000, not the complete 1,000 that are in the new Gourmet Today cookbook. These are not recipes that you've been publishing in Gourmet.
Some of them have been. Some of them were just so great when we developed them. We thought, we can't wait 5 years for this to come out. It's got to, a lot of these recipes we're just really thrilled about. And it's hard to say, we got to wait till it comes out in the book.
You mentioned rices. You have a lot of different rices. You have basmati, which I don't know whether you like Tex-Mati and Kasmati and some of the other matis that are available in most of the stores. It's pretty much the same species of rice, isn't it?
I love all basmati rices. They're so fragrant and delicious, and they're longer. And they're actually a rice that cooks beautifully in the microwave. If you cook them in the microwave, they get longer than if you cook them conventionally.
And then some are things that I've seen that go back to my childhood, but you're doing them differently. Kasha, for example.
Kasha, I mean, all of these, you know, the grains of the past are coming back in this wonderful way, and kasha is one of them.
What about sausages? Do you make sausages at home?
I do, and there are some recipes in the book for making your own sausages. It's
you need special tools?
I mean, you need a sausage grinder. There are attachments for most stand mixers that you can get if you don't have one of those. Mine is, I think, called a porker or porkette. But it's very satisfying to make your own sausage. And then you know, I mean, you can buy, you know, great pork, humanely raised heritage pork, and make wonderful sausages with that.
We're starting to see heritage meats like Berkshire pig and Dexter beef in restaurant menus and more in meat stores as well.
Oh, I mean, that's the other thing. I mean, the meat that is now available to us is so different than even like 2 years ago. Now, in most butchers, you can get a selection of grass-fed beef. You can get a couple kinds of heritage pork. And, you know, when the last time we published a cookbook, we had to say, oh, you know, the pork is too lean. And now we can say, you know, you can get pork that has fat and that really tastes like pork.
But we do come to the thing that listeners always express concern about when we have these kinds of conversations, and that is added cost. All of the things that we're talking about, all the great things we're talking about, tend to be a little more expensive. If I want rice, really inexpensive rice, I'm going to be buying some kind of a commercially produced long grain rice that's in my supermarket. I'm not going to the basmatis or all of the other fancy rices, the Italian arborios, et cetera. They all cost a lot of money. The Berkshire pork is a lot more expensive than those cheap pork chops.
That's exactly right. And, I mean, I would say in the case of rice, if you figure it out, it comes to pennies more a portion. Rice isn't even really good rice isn't that expensive. And certainly, if you buy it in quantities, the price comes down. With meat, one of the things that you can do is get better meat, but in cheaper cuts. And one of the things that we've really done in this book is there are lots of less expensive cuts. We really tell you the kinds of things that need to be braised. And, you know, we have stopped eating so high on the hog, and we really now, as a nation, are starting to look at cheaper cuts, which is great.
And you mentioned braised. Braised short ribs, for example, have become the mainstays of restaurants these days because they're so tasty.
And of course, the other thing is pork belly, which, you know, is like there's hardly a restaurant in New York that doesn't have pork belly on its menu. And, you know, it's just uncured bacon.
So we should start thinking about stews and braising meats and things like that, the cheaper cuts. But if you go to other parts of the world, you also get smaller portions. So isn't that something that we should consider? I think I've mentioned this before, but Chinese people have told me that they can always tell whether a chef has just come over from China or whether he's been here for a long time by the proportion of meat to vegetable in a dish. Meat is just a flavoring in China, or was until recently, until I guess people started getting rich. And here it is the dominant ingredient.
Well, I think that is changing very rapidly. And I think, you know, one of the things that Gourmet Today reflects is an increasing dependence on vegetables, grains, beans, things other than the meat, and we no longer think of a plate as something that has a big piece of meat in the middle with, you know, a vegetable and a starch. We're really thinking about food in much more creative and interesting ways.
You used to be the restaurant critic for the New York Times. I'm not even going to ask you about the changes that are taking place at the Times. Frank Bruni was here recently, he was followed by Eric Ripera, the chef at Le Bernardin, who said, "I've always known what you look like." But that's a whole other story. But do you think that if you were covering restaurants today, you'd be seeing something very different than you did? How long ago did you leave the Times?
10 years ago. There's no question. I mean, restaurants have changed dramatically. I mean, just as the way we cook at home has changed, the way we eat in restaurants has, you know, certainly changed. And you just see a much, much wider variety of ingredients that are being served. And, you know, things that didn't used to be considered American now are very American. I mean, you know, all of these Asian, Latino, Spanish influences are now considered as American as pizza.
Mm-hmm. And so that's why you have a whole bunch of curries in this book as well. But the restaurant chefs have been at the forefront of concerns about talking about ethics in food. You would have thought that it would be in their best interest to not get into that discussion.
Well, I mean, they are in the... I have enormous respect for restaurant chefs. I mean, they have been in the forefront of all of these major changes. I mean, they're responsible for the green market movement. They are responsible for things like Second Harvest, for Share Our Strength. They are generous. They really understand hunger issues. And they understand ethics. I mean, they understand that if we don't pay attention to these things, we won't have good food to eat down the road, that we're at a place where we really have to pay attention now.
And you say this is an exciting time for our food culture. When people look back at this time, what do you think they'll say about it? Is this a transitionary phase?
I think they will say that Americans finally woke up and recognized. I mean, we went from being a nation of farmers to being a nation that turned its back on farms and farmers. And I think this is the period in our history which we will look back on with pride and say it's where we finally came to our senses and understood our connection to the earth.
Do you think it's ironic that I just received a book from someone who's claiming that food in France has gone into serious decline, that it's become too Americanized?
I think food in France has been in serious decline for a long time, and that it's easy for them to blame it on the Americans, but it's not our fault.
But in the end, you do find an awful lot of McDonald's and such in all throughout Europe, and it's shocking traditionalists. Are they going to be going through the same kind of transition, do you think, anytime soon?
They have to. I mean, if they want to regain their patrimony and their heritage, they are going to have to go through changes. But it's not just fast food. I mean, you know, the huge changes in France start with their bread got bad. I mean, it used to be there was great bread everywhere, and the bread got terrible.
Although now there are bakeries that have a little sign that says traditionnel, which means that they've gone back to the old ways.
Right. I mean, they are starting to wake up, but, you know, it's easy to blame it on the Americans, but they have to blame it on themselves.
Ruth Reisha will be signing books along with Gourmet's executive editor, John Willoughby. And they will be giving a demonstration, serving snacks from the book tonight at 6 at the Williams-Sonoma store in Columbus Circle. That's in the Time Warner building.
It is there, yes.
And there are some pretty good restaurants upstairs as well.
Oh, a few.
Gourmet Today is published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. And Ruth, thank you so much for coming by to talk about this book, Gourmet Today.
My pleasure. See you soon.
On tomorrow's show, former George W. Bush speechwriter Matt Latimer offers an insider's account of the final years of the Bush administration, and then we'll examine Benny Goodman's impact on classical music. Also, a look at a plague that swept across parts of Europe in the 1500s where infected people felt an uncontrollable urge to dance without stopping. Plus, Amir Axel's comprehensive history of the scientific race to harness radioactivity. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Blakeney Schick, Stephen Valentino, and Julia Corcoran. Melissa Egan is the executive producer, and we had help today from Angela Sheldon, Stephanie Bernhardt, Barbara Kahn, and contributing producer Melissa Waldron-Lehner. Debbie Fountain was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. Thanks for listening. We'll see you tomorrow.